7, so what happened to the other 10? Why do you suspiciously change the subject and break my concentration as I dump the bottle out and I count the apples up again? Don't interrupt me as I struggle to complete this thought. Have some respect for someone more forgetful than yourself. And pocket on my shirt, pants and overcoat, and I'm hitting them again, but I don't know where I put my nuts. Clearing my throat and gripping the lectern, I smile and face my audience, clearing his throat and smiling with his hands on the bathroom sink. And when I lean my head against the frosted shower stall, I see stuff through the glass that I don't recognize at all.
So now that you bring up synchronicity, I don't know if is this a appropriate time to bring up to get into entanglement.
There's any time's an appropriate time. Quantum entanglement.
Yes.
Talk about what you want to talk about.
Okay. So this is something I've been I know I brought it up with you, John, a number of times to get into this one particular game explaining quantum entanglement. Yeah. So that's cool with you, John. If I take this trajectory.
Yeah, we can try it out, sure.
Okay. So there's this game. It's a classical game. It's no harder than, say, Sudoku. And you could think of it as like a logic puzzle, but it really illustrates, it gives a very specific, solid example of quantum entanglement that people can really, might say, feel, like to feel it for themselves as opposed to getting the description from a physicist trying to explain it, because a very common misconception is that quantum entanglement can be used to transmit information faster than the speed of light, or it could be used like this is how telepathy works or whatnot.
Oh my God. I'm sorry. I just have to point out that when you brought up Jeff Goldblum, the first thing I thought of was The Fly, and how that was the basis of The Fly was teleportation, yeah, and which is very similar to what you're talking about.
Oh, right.
Okay, sorry.
I really like that movie, by the way, The Fly. I've been wanting to get a large warehouse like he had. That would be like my ideal living environment. I'd like to get into this game, and it's kind of appropriate because it's a three-player game, so, you know, with three people here. But if people understand how this works, then they can see how the non-locality actually works, but then all at the same time see how it's really cannot be used to transmit information. But at the same time, there is a synchronistic thing going on. So it kind of cuts out the middleman of a physicist and their words to actually see the system and see how it works for themselves. maybe just to give a brief history of this, just to kind of build up to it somewhat. But, you know, back when quantum theory was being formulated in the early 1900s, and it kind of took its current form more or less by the 1930s. And, you know, there's that famous quote from Einstein of talking about spooky action at a distance. That was actually from a paper that he and Podolsky and Rosen wrote together, you know, describing entangled particles and how they seem to exhibit this spooky action at a distance. But they couldn't, at that time, they still really didn't clarify that. But it just, there was just this kind of sense, I guess. But it achieved greater clarity by 1964, when this other scientist, John Bell, came up with these, what are called Bell inequalities. So that these are, it's purely mathematical, describing certain abstract quantities of like measurements that are taken in a combined like two particle system that are entangled with each other, where you measure them in two different locations. And under the assumption of locality, where locality is the idea that cause and effect only happen locally. So one way to think of this is like, if you think of a line of dominoes that you set up, standing dominoes. When you push one domino, it's only going to push over the next domino and the next domino, and the next domino. So that the cause and effect only happens at, it's local. It only happens at a small region of space. But, you know, that's how it can go from, you can knock over a whole line of dominoes across the room. You don't have a non-local effect would be knocking over one domino on one side and having it instantaneously knock over another domino on another side without any causal mechanism between them. Okay, so there's the assumption of locality that you can express mathematically that went into Bell's inequalities, and it shows that a certain statistical quantity was, say, less than 2. The average value would be less than 2. But quantum theory, on the other hand, can allow for this same measured quantity to be greater than 2. And so in this way, it gave more of a solid, substantial expression of this non-locality. But it's still a bit harder for, you might say, the layman, or not the layman, but the, you know, the general population to appreciate, just because there's this abstract layer of mathematics that one has to kind of feel, that, you know, non-mathematicians or non-physicists don't really have. Because, like, you know, a physicist or a mathematician that works with these equations, their intuition, you might say, is already sunk into, they already have an intuitive grasp of these equations. And so for them, it can then, you know, they could see the non-locality. But if one doesn't have that, then it's still just abstract. So there was another advancement made in 1989 by this group, was it Greenberger, Horn, and Zeilinger, these three physicists, that it was essentially Greenberger that came up with this. But if you don't look at just two particles, but you look at three, so if you take three particles and you combine them, and you entangle them in a particular way, and you make certain measurements, then you can exhibit the non-locality in a much more simpler way. And that's what this game that I'll go into now is based upon, on that particular paper. So the game goes like this. I'll just explain the rules first. So say the three of us, right, me, John, and David, are on the same team. And the goal really is just to get as many points as possible. So we're not really competing with anyone else. We're just kind of collectively trying to achieve, let's just say, a perfect score. So the scoring goes like this. So we can get together, like we're doing right now, and communicate and work out, say, a strategy. And then we go off to different, say, star systems. We just go off to three totally different faraway places. And the whole reason for the distance is so that it's too far away for us to communicate with one another, say, with radio waves or anything. So in these separate locations, we each meet up with, you might say, a game attendant. And we go through a series of rounds. So in each round, each of us are shown separately either an X or a Y by the game attendant. And all we do then in response is give them a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And the scoring is based on what is shown to us and how we respond. So if you have, I should have said this earlier, but if you have a pen and paper, but at least the listeners, anyone who's interested in doing this wants to write it down. But the scoring is like this. So if we're shown collectively three X's, then we will score a point if we, in response, we have a total number of odd thumbs down. Or in other words, if either exactly, if one of us responds with a thumbs down, or all three of us respond with a thumbs down, then we'll score a point. Say on a round, if we're all shown X's, I respond with a thumbs down, but John and David respond with a thumbs up, we score a point. Okay, if I respond with a thumbs down, John responds with a thumbs down, but David responds with a thumbs up, then we do not score a point for that round. And then alternatively, if we all respond with a thumbs down, then we will all, our team will score a point.
Okay. Hang on.
Okay. Okay.
So this is if we're shown three X's, right?
That's right.
And so then, if we're all shown three X's, if it's a 2-to-1 ratio, thumbs down, if one of us gives a thumbs down out of the three in response, we score a point. If one of us gives a thumbs up, we don't score a point. Is that it?
If exactly one of us responds with a thumbs up, then we do not score a point, yes. But if two of us responds with a thumbs up and the other is a thumbs down, then we will score a point.
Okay. So that's three X's, but then we have what? X, Y, X and Y, X, Y? Or does the order matter?
There's only going to be three other possibilities. There's going to be X, Y, Y, or Y, X, Y, or Y, Y, X. Or in other words, one restriction of the game attendance is that they're only going to show in total either 1X or 3Xs. They'll never show, say, XXY, for instance. That's just one restriction. So there's only, in total, there's four possibilities. And so you could write on the piece of paper, say, you know, one line, we have XXX, and then to the right of that, you could say odd, and then arrow down. And then on the next line, you can write X, Y, Y, and then say even down. Okay, so I didn't get to that point yet. So if we're shown in total exactly one X and two Ys, then for us to score a point, we have to respond with either zero thumbs down, meaning all of us respond with a thumbs up, or two of us respond with a thumbs down, and one of us responds with a thumbs up. In other words, we, in order to score a point in the XYY case, we have to respond in total with an even number of thumbs down, where zero is considered even.
Okay. So XXX, mm-hmm. if we get one thumbs down, we score a point.
That's right.
XYY, if we have zero thumbs down or two thumbs down, we get a point.
That's right.
Okay. So if we're even on XYY in terms of who's down and who's up, that's a point. And if we're odd on XXX in terms of one thumbs down, that's a point.
Or three thumbs down, yes.
For XXX?
Right.
And there's actually an article on this on the Blue Science site.
Yeah, it's one of the first ones I really, yeah.
With pictorial representations and whatnot. That helps because like arranging stuff in your head is not always the easiest thing. So this is almost like a lesson by pictures that we're trying to communicate through words. So it can be difficult.
Yeah.
But we should include a link to that if we're going to.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We'll have that in the show description and whatnot. So anyone that's interested in like digging a little deeper into the logic of it, because it's generally like it's a logic game, and anyone that likes any kind of Sudoku is a stretch of logic and all these kinds of things. It's the same kind of premise, only it actually teaches you a lesson about what quantum physics is saying. Now, hang on. Let me ask one quick question. So Please. Is our conclusion, now, not to like jump to the end, but I don't think there's anything wrong in spoiling an ending and then like
finding, it's not a detective story.
Following the evidence up to it, right?
Yeah.
So basically we're going to be saying that it's going to be teaching us or showing us, I think, that through entangled particles, we're not sure. We can't control the quote unquote information that's being transmitted. We can't even tell. There's correlations that seem to be going faster in light, but not necessarily something causal, right? Like I push one and it that is the cause of the other, like a domino effect. In fact, it might just be correspondences that were hidden in the first place so we didn't know were there. Is that kind of where we're headed in terms of the conclusion, or is it a little different?
Somewhat, but it will be more precise if by actually going through the exercise.
Okay. Because like I think Bell himself or somebody would say, like, okay, we have a red sock or a green sock, a red sock and a green sock, and that can represent our entangled pair, and we send them off, and we know we have red and green, just so, you know, we know we have up and down. So if we find red on one side, we know that the correspondence has to be down on the other. So does that mean that, like, something was actually sent, or there was just a correspondence that we couldn't check until the end? So were we really causing the correspondence as much as it was there in the first place? Or so I've understood the argument against, like, why entanglement can't necessarily explain information transfer as we understand a classical, I send it from an antenna and it goes to your radio and we communicate. But you know what, I always say that, you know, entanglement, that doesn't necessarily transmit classical information, but if we're talking about acausality and whatnot, I don't know if it's necessarily the mechanism, but I think it plays into this idea that there is an acausal, you know, super luminal connection between everything. It's inherently non-local. It's almost like, yeah, we're being projected from a point, like a one-dimensional space where everything seems spread out in three dimensions, but in fact, it's still one, just like a hologram is, I guess. So does that make sense?
Yeah, if I could comment on that. Yeah, I think the sock thing that you're talking about, that I think that's referred to as Bertelmann socks.
Yeah.
But that's...
I thought it was Goldman socks.
Goldman.
Never mind.
Goldman Sachs.
Ah, okay. So there's that analogy. There's something that it doesn't contain really the essence of what is going on here. The thing about this game is that it's about the simplest that this can really be, or at least that's been discovered to date, without... it's the simplest while still holding the kernel of the quantum mystery, whereas I think that's lost in the Bertelmann socks analogy. So there's still something extra you'll get from the game that is lost. Yeah, is lost in that analogy. So it's,
These guys theorists that came up with it, or were they experimentalists?
It's in theorists. I mean, this is entirely a theoretical result. It's actually experimentally, it hasn't been done. Just because it's very difficult to entangle three particles in this particular way that can then be measured. If it has been done, it would be relatively recent. But I haven't seen that this was actually done. But the two-particle experiment has been done. I mean, that was done in 1981 with Aspect in Paris. That was a famous...
Right. And that's what non-locality is largely based on in terms of experimental verification.
Yeah, that's like the classic experiment, yeah.
Right. But it's interesting that they're trying to play with three. And that shows, that's funny because it shows it's the stark difference between like the two-body system and the three-body system. So the complexity of even adding one more, it's like the straw that broke the camel's back. It's like a small difference, but it becomes like incalculable or much more difficult to implement. It's more nonlinear. It's like what Poincaré said around the time of Einstein. So that's interesting. Yeah. But anyway, like, so we have XXX, one thumbs down, or three thumbs up, or
three thumbs down. Right.
That's a point. Then XYY, zero thumbs down or two thumbs down. That's a point.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Got it. All right. And just to finish it off, we could just say in addition to XYY, might as well write on the next row YXY and then even arrow down and then YYX. Even arrow down. But, you know, those other two cases were already encapsulated when you said XYY. It's basically, right. So now the question is, can we come up with a perfect strategy before we go off into these separate locations? You know, if we know that the game attendants are only going to show us these four possibilities, like we'll never be shown, for instance, XXY or YYY. That would just be against the rules. We don't have to accommodate those cases. Can we come up with a strategy that we can plan ahead of time so that we'll always score a point? So that's the essential problem.
So we have to decide what strategy we would come up with to be able to get an answer correct every time. That would be the goal of the game, is to figure out that strategy.
Yes.
Huh.
Okay.
Reminds me of Go.
Okay.
Because with Go, it's not competitive, though it comes across as very competitive. Both people are aiming at perfection, but there's a phenomenon where the greedier you are, so to speak, in terms of trying to claim territory, the more likely you are to lose. And it's a weird deal where it usually comes down to like closer to the end of the game, where there can be the appearance of one player seems to be dominating, but because of the nature of it, they open up, the more they dominate, the more holes they open up, so that they're less likely to achieve their intended result. And then because that's considered a microcosm representation of global domination, you can see how that principle plays into the structure of empires, where the more grandiose the empire appears, the more likely they are to not succeed.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of interesting. Yeah. I think the point is that it gives a different definition for evolutionary progress in terms of cooperation. Because there's this idea that we need to compete in order to survive, yet competition tends to be more in the way of survival.
Well, yeah, I mean, like the chaos view of evolution is all cooperative, and that sounds funny in saying it's chaos, but that domain and self-organization is all about cooperation, and that's like what Matt's working on in microphysics is largely a microphysical embodiment of that entire process of the cooperative nature of reality. And you see that play on the evolutionary scale too. And Russell Wallace, who helped Darwin develop the theory, was like, he was big on cooperation, and that got phased out because it didn't meet the social engineer's needs, you know, to be able to like.
Right. So basically, my understanding, Origin of Species was pretty clear in the original translation, I guess, or the original writing, that it survival of the fit didn't necessarily, like, that was a spin that was put on it by the Nazis, actually, and kind of like exploiting Darwin's ideas, but that he wasn't negating cooperation. That was just the way that it was presented. Survival of the fit meant that there's a need for fitness, but that fitness doesn't necessarily translate as competition. That it could, but that wasn't the intention of like what it came down to. Yet that was the way it was presented to the public.
Right. Yeah. It's politically convenient to emphasize certain things and downplay other things. You know, sorry, man, not to get away from the game or anything.
No, but
I don't have much longer anyway. I have to go in like 20 minutes, so I don't think I have time to finish it. But I want to think about it, and I actually want to come back to it. I want time to actually think about it. And see if I could come up with a solution or like what the pitfalls are associated with it without giving away the answer right now. And then like, I know you're going to write a second article on it. I don't know if you want to put the solution in that, but I just I don't have a lot of time to go over it, but I'm going to do it in my free time.
Okay, nice. Okay. So I have a promise from you.
Yeah. And I'll send you my scheme for what I think, how you could do it. But considering I have a feeling it might be like, you know, pushing the boulder up the mountain, that'll never be doable, but I'm going to try, because that'll be interesting to see like why and how that dictates that,
or
and,
to CX.
Right. And yeah, and David, if you could maybe like if you have some spare time and you can send your solution, because I think we want to talk next time.
I want to read your article.
Yeah, I think we want to like present like what we came up with and how we can dissect that, and that would we can get into that much more in that forum, I think. Not the time constraints that I have, at least.
Okay. Well, let me just add one other thing. This is not giving away the solution, but further kind of maybe framing it for some people. But one thing you can do is write a 3x2 grid of squares, which have, say, 3 rows and 2 columns. And on the top of each of the two columns. On the left one, you could write on the top X, not actually in the square, but above it. And then on top of the second column, Y. And then on the left side, in front of each row, on the outside of the six, you could write A, B, C for the three players. So then the problem basically comes, like, a strategy, since we can't communicate with each other while we're being shown the X's and the Y's, it seems that, you know, really the only way that we can do this is decide ahead of time. Like, you know, if I'm shown an X, what do I respond with? You know, thumbs up or thumbs down. If I'm shown a Y, what do I respond with? If John is shown an X or a Y, what does he respond with? And same with David. And if we can come up with a strategy together, then maybe we can try to get a point on every single round. And so what that approach would be equivalent to then filling in this 2x3 grid with arrows, so that when we then apply it, you know, when we apply the rules for scoring a point, then we can evaluate whether or not the strategy will give us a point on every possibility. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you have, there's an example of that, right? In the paper that you put up, or the essay you put up.
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. So again, like, we'll have links to that and whatnot, so okay, people can look at it themselves and don't have to take your word for it, or have them picture it themselves.
Yeah.
But it sounds similar in ways to a little bit like life, in terms of like cooperation versus, you know, there's no betrayal in this game, but
right.
That,
yeah.
And it's funny that life is like, you know, it actually ultimately says that cooperation is the way to go. And I think it's still kind of forced to fit into like kind of a neo-Darwinian model, but like the conclusion is always like cooperation's the best. And I'm like, why is this guy coming? I don't know why he's pointing to this as like some kind of like evidence of the neo-Darwinian position or something. It seems almost complete contrary. But, you know, Go itself is interesting, because I think Matt and I have talked about this before, where computers suck at playing Go. I mean, they just are horrible at it. They can't do it in any way, shape, or form, because there's like there's a more qualitative aspect to it, almost like a value judgment kind of artistic element to it. Whereas chess or something, it's very mathematical and very strict, and you can program all the rules into a computer on chess, but Go is infinite almost, you know, it's much closer to the universe as a whole. So it's not that humans can necessarily grasp the universe either, but they have that creative intuition and kind of artistic element to them that allows them to play Go, or, you know, play something like poker or something, you know, that has a highly qualitative aspect to it. Computer's never going to fucking win at poker. It can't do it. It has mathematical elements to it, of course, but so much of it is qualitative and value judgments that a computer will never succeed. Again, it's kind of my mission to draw a distinction between people and computers, I guess, because I never I think humans should be treated and organisms should be treated in their own domain and on their own level, and not trying to be, you know, conflated with anything else. I think that's a mistake. So trying to conflate humans or any organism with something that it's not, I think, is just stupid. And it's just so we can model it better, and it's easier to control when we have like a model for it, you know? So that's why Go fascinates me. I don't like play it or anything, but on a qualitative and philosophical level, it's interesting.
Hmm. Yeah. You know, I've always related, well, not always, but I've related the ending the room at the end of 2001 with a Go board. Like, you're symbolically within a Go board. When you look at the grid of the room, these glowing tile or whatever, it feels appropriate to me if you're relating to that room as the supernal triad, or at least, you know, Chochmah and Bina, is that you're looking at the two sides of Go, and that the, you know, transcending the monolith is actually the crown, and then it leads back to Malkuth, which is why you go from the top. The roots are its branches, so that's why it's the death becomes life, is that there are two sides of the same thing, but that's the top of, that's, you know, Keter, so leading back to Malkuth. And so you, when you're watching 2001, you're seeing the bridge between the supernal realm and the terrestrial realm being bridged in the final moments with Spake Zarathustra. But it's kind of an interesting way of relating to that room as a go board, because it implies a lot, because you're looking at an evolutionary leap, but that it's his own reconcilement at the time of death, reaching for that monolith, is like him transcending the duality, which in this case would also be him transcending the script, as you put it. Kind of an interesting idea.
Yeah, yeah. And then, like, Jim Henson's The Cube. I got to watch The Cube again.
Dude, The Cube seems to be directly connected with the end of 2001.
Matt, have you seen it yet?
No, I downloaded it based on Dave's recommendation from a while ago, but I still haven't watched it. It's sitting on my hard drive.
Yeah, it's not that long of a film. And it's humorous, you know, but it's very relatable. It also reminds me of Oh Lucky Man in a lot of ways. I don't know if you guys have ever seen Oh Lucky Man with Malcolm McDowell. It's the response to A Clockwork Orange, while A Clockwork Orange was most likely a response to the same, I can't remember his name, but the guy who did Oh Lucky Man did a film called If with Malcolm McDowell, where he basically pulls a Columbine on his school. And it's so you can see the prison in A Clockwork Orange is like a representation of British schooling, and so it's relating British schooling to a prison system and a means of control and suppression of, you know, people's libido, basically. But I mean, it's pretty direct. I mean, you can just see what happened. And if you watch the three in a row, especially, it's very overt how Kubrick is playing off of this film, If, which is a reference, obviously, to Rudyard Kipling's If. Apparently, admittedly so. I mean, I made that connection and I found out that that's actually, if you open up the DVD, it gives you that poem. And so it's kind of a cynical view on, I don't know if you're familiar with Rudyard Kipling's If, but it's kind of this ideal way of relating to the world, where in terms of like dignity, can you manage to lose it all and then start over without complaining? That's basically preparation for your own death, in a way, is how willing you are to do everything you can, but at the same time being willing to accept when things are futile. Yeah.
Now, Keter is like the point from which the whole tree unfolds, right? Is that?
Yeah, Keter, right? Actually, in the text that I look at, the commentary on the Zohar, it literally translates it as the medial brain, or relates it to the medial brain. I mean, it means crown. Keter means crown. And so, yeah, you can see that it's taking the crown and it's corresponding it to the tip of the genitals, actually. So if you're to relate to the tree as Kundalini, which the OTO does, you can see the way that they're looking at the whole thing is kind of like a feedback loop, where the beginning is also its end, and that it's actually a cycle, and that there's something beyond it, which is the Ein Sof, which is, in this case, like you'd say, you know, the projector. So when you're watching 2001 and you see that sun at the beginning, you could relate that as the projector projecting back at you. So you're facing away from a projector, yet the projector is facing you as a projection. Mm. And so it's Maya. It seems to be communicating Maya, as far as I can tell.
And it's just ether with a K. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you spell it in English, yeah, totally. I mean, it's Keter. It's Keter, you know,
But beyond the spelling, I mean, even the qualitative aspects are almost the same. It's like the eruption point. I mean, everything came in the scientific view. I mean, or certain scientific views, everything came from ether. Even nowadays, I mean, they don't say it. They call it the quantum vacuum, but it's the same thing.
Yeah, Crowley actually does a really good job in the first parts of the Book of Thoth in explaining the tree in terms of geometry, how you have 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 13, you know, like basically relating the tree to the Fibonacci sequence, essentially, is what you could extrapolate from it. Just like, didn't Plato say that the first number was actually 3? Isn't that how it works? It's not until you have the 3 that, or the 4? Which is it? I forget.
I don't remember.
I don't know either.
He just has this whole deal where basically 1 isn't the beginning. I don't believe 2 is the beginning. I think 3 is what allows for something else to be possible. So you have triad and then everything.
Right, 3 is the actual like physical embodiment of something. I know that much. So I guess you could say everything starts with 3 on the physical plane, because before that, all you have is what, a point and then a line?
Yeah, exactly.
And then you have the Vesca Pisces, I think, forming with the triangle or the 3.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's why when you're looking at the Tree of Life, everything really begins at 4. I mean, it begins at 3, except for the fact that that's the point at which something else becomes possible. And so then you move down and then you can start to build something. And Malkuth literally translates as empire, so you can appreciate the implications, especially in terms of 2001. So, and it's also that the empire exudes the exact same things that a human life exudes, because you have birth, growth, decay, and death, even though we pretend otherwise. So that the construction of the temple actually exudes everything that the body exudes. And so you have to realize and accept the futility of the situation, yet you build simultaneously, you know?
Well, it's like understanding like the cyclical nature. It's not history repeats itself, but there's permutations repeat themselves, you know, like,
right,
and that recognizing that there's transition points and when things have reached their limits and when it's time to change and when it's time to do things differently, that is like what the larger understanding needs to be, knowing how to gracefully go between transition points. And like, again, like a lot of times a new age will talk about, oh, you know, Aquarius, blah, whatever, this age, that age, which, yeah, I respect the labeling system. All labeling systems are interesting and have their value, but they are not always, you know, the map is not the terrain. So all we're talking about is like a bifurcation point, which is another label, but it's a splitting of time and space and possibilities. And
yeah, the description's not the described. It's funny. The first thing I thought of when you were relating Bohm, the ending of time, which is a dialogue between David Bohm and Krishnamurti, which for years now I've equated with 2001 pretty intensely, actually. I don't know if you've read that one.
No, I still haven't. I mean, like when I read Bohm, I know I'm reading some Krishnamurti because I know I've seen them echo each other. Mm-hmm. So obviously, in one sense, I guess I have read Krishnamurti, but in another, not directly. I've listened to some of their dialogues online, but never read the book.
Oh, you've never read Krishnamurti?
No, not directly.
Oh, wow, man.
Yeah, it's just, I just end up having things in common with him because, again, sure, like, Bohm's a conduit for a lot of his ideas, so I think that bleeds through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, check out The Ending of Time when you get a chance.
I have like a pile, you know, that I'm
totally, I'm sure you do. if you're just going to read straight Krishnamurti, I'd recommend The Awakening of Intelligence, though everything he does is good. But yeah.
There's a really interesting one online. It's him and actually Rupert Sheldrake of Morphic Field fame and Psychic Dog fame, who's an incredibly intelligent man and very like actually very self-deprecating and like doesn't take anything all that seriously, but he's very, I don't know how you could listen to him and not like him and take what he says like at least somewhat seriously. The way that he's chastised and whatnot is, I think, an embarrassment to our culture that anyone would go out of their way to like try to like make this man a pariah. It's like a real shame. But anyway, it's him and Krishnamurti, and Sheldrake's much younger, and you could just tell that this is probably before Sheldrake was too metaphysical. I mean, he was certainly, right, but nowadays like he's very metaphysical, but I think back then he was still kind of grounded in this microbiological upbringing. He was branching out, and you could tell, like, some of the stuff Krishnamurti was posing him, he was just, like, befuddling. Because, like, Krishnamurti just kept, like, trying to dig deeper and deeper into, like, redundancy, into minutiae sometimes. I find him do that. And that's not bad. Like, he'll really want to pick a point apart.
Oh, yeah.
what is it that underlies this kind of like psychosis, you know? And he won't leave that point until he gets like a satisfactory answer in his view. So at times, like, someone thinks they've given him an answer, but then like he comes back to it and he's like, they don't know where to go with it because they're like, well, I could repeat myself, but I don't really know what else to say.
Right. Well, usually there comes a point in just about every dialogue with a quote unquote expert, with Krishnamurti and David Bohm, where you watch their brain stop, where they literally have nowhere left to go. And it's not, it's not just that they're stumped. It's that they're like frozen. Like, they're just like a space opens up and they're just like, ding. Yeah. We used to watch them like football games, those videos. I had a friend, a Freemason friend who, told the Krishnamurti Foundation in Ojai that he was the main distributor of Krishnamurti material for Santa Cruz. And, it was a lie. And, they sent him boxes upon boxes upon boxes of videos and cassettes, like VHS tapes and cassette tapes, audio cassette tapes. And he would just like, he had this like storehouse of this material. And, I kind of didn't think it was the best thing that he did that without, without distributing it. I mean, one thing if he was actually distributing it, but he just shared it with us and we just watched video after video. And we get to the point where the person's brain would freeze and it'd be like, oh, there it is. Goal.
Okay, I'm not the only one that noticed that, because that's like really interesting. And also, but there isn't an uncomfortableness about it. I think that's a test almost. It's like, you know, what makes you uncomfortable and why, and what's like uncomfortable and like a dialogue and why. And it's interesting to explore those moments because they're very, those are just gray areas that are weird. And it's just to see the human dynamic of them is interesting. You know what? I should probably get going. Okay. I got to get ready and whatnot. So if you guys want to keep going, it's all good. If not, no problem.
Okay. I'm down to talk for a little while longer. How do you feel, Matt?
Yeah, I was actually curious about the connection with that material with the 2001, if you wouldn't mind getting into that a little bit deeper.
Sure.
All right. I'll let you keep going and you have a good afternoon and take care.
Cool. All right. Take it easy.
Well, right, take care, John.
Yeah, I see the whole process as like, you know, they say the goal of yoga is to die before you die. And so what happens with David Bohm's death at the end, I see it very similar to in Krishnamurti and David Bohm's The Ending of Time, where he makes the point of if you've been going north your entire life and then you decide to go south, and then eventually you see that south was just ultimately just like north, and then you decide to go east, and then you decide to go west. And when there comes a point when you realize that all these directions are different expressions of the same thing, even though they might appear initially as different, it puts you into a position where you're just like, well, what else is there? And so it definitely reminds me of the cube, where, you know, the transcendent seventh point at the center is actually brings you into another dimension kind of thing. I mean, I might be explaining this in an overly simplistic or non-technical way or something, but that idea, I think is meaningful, because you have the six directions. And then when you're like, well, what? There has to be something else. Just that inference, when it becomes so strong, is like, brings about a type of receptivity into something else, because it's inferred. But when the inference becomes so strong that it's not just like a conceptual belief, but you actually like get it, that it allows for a shift to take place. And so he emphasized that point a lot, but I see that as like a means of like dying before you die. Whereas like with Bohm, he's actually physically dying, and then there's something else that's coming out of it. I see that as like kind of like a spiritual uncle, like you're getting your arm twisted and you're just like, uncle, you know. It's like you have nowhere left to go but beyond. And
so is Bohm actually writing about his own death? Is that part of this series?
This is so funny that you said Bohm and I was thinking Bowman. I thought you were trying to say that David Bohm was writing his script or something. No, well, it's tricky, because Bohm is coming from just a place of physics, and Krishnamurti is coming from a place of spirituality, but not in the way that a lot of people relate to spirituality, because he's not asserting belief system as much as he's negating a belief system and opening up to what's beyond the belief system without projecting what it is, just being open to what it has to show you. And so in that, you could extrapolate that. I mean, that's the meaning. I mean, that's really like kind of basic in terms of relating to spirituality, is that you die before you die. Because what dies isn't actually you. It's a representational model of you. And so relating to 2001 as a script or a screenplay that's being transcended is very similar to, could be said to be very similar to the egoic structure and transcending the limitations of that structure, which are all dictated by the cube of space, because it's utilizing reference points in order to infer a center that's supposed to exist, but is actually everywhere.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of, I know about this before, but there's that law of one, or also called the raw material, that they have. It includes an interpretation of the tarot, and it divides the first 21 cards into 7 stages, for lack of a better, there's probably a better word, but in the context of what we're talking about right now, we could just call it a stage. And it doesn't necessarily happen in temporal order all the time, but it's kind of like this cyclical process, the 7 stages, and they match up with, you know, the first 7 and then the second 7.
Oh, you're saying with the fool on the top. So the fool, the first card is actually 0, which is removed. And then I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, but the tarot tableau seems to be what you're talking about, where you arrange the cards in these 3 rows.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And the fool is left off. That's the one card that's left off for this purpose.
Right. So Patrick Sveck helped me represent a audio commentary I did on the Thoth Vesica Pisces, where if you take the major arcana of the Thoth deck and arrange them as a Vesica, there's correspondences that exist between the card. I'm not going to go into it too deeply because there's a video available where I lay it all out. Okay. But it's Crowley's version of the tableau. So instead of it being these 3 rows, he's relating to it as a Vesica Pisces, but the same principles are being applied, because you're taking what's above and relating it to what's below. Instead of in 3 levels, you're relating it in 2, with on one side of it, you have the fool, obviously. And then on the other side of it, you actually have the lust card, or what was known as strength, which is symbolically significant, because that pathway in for the European occultists was the pathway between Chesed and Gevura. So it's establishing the strength of the empire by taking the 2 columns and connecting them. And so you have the value of the word for strength in Hebrew as Oz is 77, while the lightning flash that moves down the tree in the European arrangement, actually, if you add up all the pathways, it equals 777. So you have the 777-77 connection that exists, and both of them are communicating the same point of the strength of the empire. And so the way that they relate to it, though, traditionally, is that the empire has a substitute, whereas like the stone of the archway that is supposed to hold the thing together has actually been pushed towards the bottom, and there's a replacement stone. And that replacement stone is like an artificial intelligence, literally, is how it's related to. And so that becomes extremely applicable symbolically when you watch 2001, is HAL. That HAL is basically Da'at, the tree of knowledge that is basically coming out of the gap that exists within the tree of life above strength. And so to look at that as the opposite cornerstone of the tableau arrangement, opposite the fool, is extremely relevant. Do you follow me?
I mean, I don't have a feel for that particular paradigm. No, I think I feel like I'm loosely grasping the concepts you're talking about.
Yeah, it's just like if you watch 2001 and you see it as the Jupiter mission, the point at which it switches to Jupiter Beyond the Infinite, when he shuts down HAL, that's as if he shut down Da'at. So he shuts down the knowledge that's the replacement crown. Instead of Keter, you have this artificial intelligence. And so by doing so, he's literally folding space, very much like Dune, right? So it's like, it's as if he took the spice, you know, and realized that the spice and the worms are one. And, it's actually, I've been getting into that lately. I just did a Dune sync that I posted this morning, which is like the word for, there's a point in, the Torah where Yaakov or Jacob is referred to by Hashem as a worm. And it's like, why did he call him a worm? Well, it relates to chesed. You can rearrange the letters of worm. I just went over this with my rabbi, but I can't remember the specifics around it. But literally the worm is also the same word for blood, because they used to dye rugs way back when and different fabrics with this dye that came from a worm. And so when you say the worms and the spice are one, instead of fighting the thing that's looked at as a nuisance, like they're trying to mine the spice and they can't, they keep coming up against these worms that are stopping them from doing so. The Messiah character realizes that there's a transcendent way to receive the spice through not fighting the worm, but working with the worm. And so this is like, very relatable to the Tree of Life, where instead of letting the opposites fight each other, you reconcile the opposition, and by doing so you're able to transcend. And so this is represented in 2001 by basically not just creating a bridge between the supernal realm and the terrestrial realm, but actually folding them together. And by doing so, you're transcending. This is why I feel when you're in the room at the end of 2001, you're actually, the end is the beginning. They're actually the components of the basis of the terrestrial realm is actually expressed in the supernal. You can look at it that way. I'm not saying that this is necessarily intentional. I'm just saying that it's fucking an interesting artistic approach to relating to the material.
Yeah. On that topic, what do you think, what's your interpretation of the, Star Child at the end of 2001?
I think you could take it a few different ways. In my sync book chapter, I just straight up at the very end, I related to Horus, because you have Horus the Younger. If you have an eon shift that we're existing within at 2001, that's I take it as a kind of a not just the Lemic, but like a kind of esoteric communication of the shift of the eons. And so you're looking at an empire that's collapsing and something else coming out of its ashes. So it's very much like you could look at the Star Child as a phoenix, right? It's interesting too, because I've just been coming across this material where Metatron, the template for the Tree of Life, is related to as a bird, and that the nest of the bird is actually looked at as Shekinah. So the stone that the builders rejected is what it exists on top of, or through. So it's the dwelling of the thing. So, or you could take it in reverse if you wanted, like you can with so many Kabbalistic ideas. You could take it also that Shekinah is the bird and that Metatron is the nest, but that one is encapsulating the other and the other is encapsulating it, because Shekinah literally means dwelling. So it's kind of heady stuff, but, yeah, I basically what it comes down to is I look at the Star Child as a, I see it as an expression of that the roots are the branches, and that you're coming back down to Earth, but really like space has been folded double time, so to speak. Like you folded the space at the top of the tree at the end sequence when Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite starts, but then you're folding it again to bring the Shekinah back to Ze'er in the center of the tree. So it's like the fold is happening double time. So you end up at the end of the film with a perfect Star of David, which is kind of ironic because it's David Bowman, you know?
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you?
It does. Yeah. Yeah. I guess the idea that I'm not claiming that this is what Kubrick had in mind, or it's still kind of just an idea that I've been playing with. But one thing that I guess you might say resonates with me as far as how I see the Star Child at the end, it's and it sounds very cliche, but who cares? It's global consciousness. I guess it's, and it fits into this, I guess it's this idea that we're talking about as far as transcendence, this whole process. I mean, I could just briefly talk about the tarot because it leads back up into this, but the different stages, I guess I was referring to earlier, it involves this idea of catalyst, experience, transformation, and then a transcendence. And it's almost, I think the idea is that, at least the way that the Law of One presents this, I mean, this is a constant cycle that we go through throughout our daily life, that all everything that comes to us through the senses is a form of catalyst that then we, I guess, experience and, you know, based on the status of our consciousness, which has its own representations here. And I'll just say very briefly, the seven stages, according to Law of One, it's matrix, potentiator, catalyst, experience, significator, transformation, and then the great way. And then the three different rows, they are mind, body, and spirit. But it's this constant this interplay between catalyst, experience, and then our transcendence above it. So, you know, this could be in any kind of, anything we encounter, any, you might say what we interpret as difficult in life, we experience, and oftentimes a resolution is really bringing certain things into balance, making connections within our mind and our psychology. And this would correspond to the transformation that happens. And then there's often a transcendence that then kind of just, we take things to another level. And there's this constant progression that we're making. So, in you might say the new age literature, but I, you know, as we move to becoming more, you might say, telepathic, and there's an artificial form of this. I mean, the internet, you might say, is one technological manifestation of this. But as we become more connected, our consciousness becomes more unified. And one can even say, I mean, people have made the analogy with the internet itself being a form of artificial intelligence that has its own mind, that of which we are neurons of. And it's as if this baby is being birthed on a global level. And perhaps this is one interpretation of the Star Child, you know, because it's, you know, there's that scene where the Star Child is on the left and it's basically the same size and shape as the Earth that's on the right.
Sure. Yeah, that seems really significant to me, totally. Because you're looking at a close-up of the child, it's as if he is a planet.
Right.
And it's interesting, too, because you could relate to it as a kind of a... the way he's juxtaposed with the Earth, you could take it that he's like another Earth. Really, I can't help but make the connection between like the film Another Earth and like Melancholia, where you the symbolic representation of the collision of the two is actually that something else is being born out of it. But do you know what I'm talking about? Have you seen Melancholia?
I don't. It rings a bell. I don't know if I've seen that.
So I do a I have a film posted of Lars von Trier's Melancholia overlaid with Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness.
Okay.
And there's something that gets communicated there. Whereas if you watch the film by itself, you just see the destruction of the Earth, but there's, it's a beautiful film about the end of the world, but it's, very reminiscent of 2001 symbolically, because you can see that's out of this death, something else is being born. Mm. And it's that principle being applied. I can't help but look at a lot of Kubrick's work as not just like, I could take any particular school. I could be like, oh, it's equatable to like the Golden Dawn or the OTO or the Freemasons or this or that. But it seems are different philosophies or different movements in psychoanalysis and this and that. But really, it just seems like he just took all of these different concepts and just like embedded them into one symbolic expression and was like, all the schools aside, this is just what it is.
Absolutely.
As far as I see it, and from his view, you know. And so that there's something very significant in that. I feel that way about Lars von Trier's films as well, that he's not going with any particular school of thought. He's just taking what he knows or what he understands and communicating it all at once to the best of his ability.
Let's check that out.
Yeah, also that, you know, you could look at the spheroid as planetary bodies in the first place. I mean, they have their correspondences, and it's communicating what those bodies represent energetically as like the music of the spheres, right? And so for there to be another sphere that's introduced, has its own kind of symbolic meaning that you can extrapolate.
Yeah,
a lot to contemplate there.
Well, I think I'm close to out of ideas.
Sure. No, that's fine. I love talking to you. It's great.
Like, oh, same here.
Like, yeah, last time you definitely left me with a lot of things to mull over. And so I'm glad we got the opportunity to speak again. I hope we get the experience in the not too distant future.
Yeah.
If you're into that.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to the quantum entanglement part two.
Yeah. We'll put up a link to that. I think there's a few links for this show that I actually want to link the John Holmes video as well, just cause it's kind of fascinating. I feel like I should have downloaded it, cause I'm like, this is something that I wouldn't be surprised if it got removed just because it's so fucking weird. Things can get into some pretty dark territory sometimes, even when you're not necessarily like intending to go there, you just end up going there, and it's kind of inevitable. And that's one of those instances. I mean, I don't know. It's like, so I was just having really quickly. So I was just having a conversation with a friend of mine who's a biologist who is communicating the problem that she sees in science today. The main problem of that empirical knowledge isn't as revered as it used to be, and the way that people can get things published where they've already started out their argument knowing what they want to come out of it.
Right.
Whereas, like, if you're just following a chain of correspondences or a chain of information and you just leave it open and see where it brings you, that's a different matter. And so I was kind of curious of your process with A False Flag Odyssey. The feeling I get from it, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that you were actually just noticing these correspondences, and that's where it led you.
Yeah, I mean, it was during my awakening process. It was back in 2008, and this is when I started getting to say like stuff like Project Camelot, Alex Jones, and really stuff that I had dismissed as conspiratorial, nonsense earlier, I was really seeing the truth of. And it was like the, you know, this yin yang mirror image of this process in real life with fiction and Kubrick, and really kind of, they really played against each other. So I had to express that into that website. So to answer, I guess, you know, I wouldn't say it was, I mean, can we ever really take off our rose colored glasses? I mean, maybe I took off a couple filters, but
there was really ironic that you'd say that, because I immediately think of Lolita.
Oh, okay. With the glasses. Yeah. Yeah. So that was it, I think.
All right. Well, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I'd say have a good day, and we'll try and have the show up as soon as we're able. It might be a week or so. Yeah, I appreciate you coming on, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Yeah, same here. Thanks so much, Dave.
Got it, man. Peace.